Eleanor Beardsley reports that the sequel to the 1987 hit Wall Street could not have appeared at a riper time.
Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps is a high-intensity dramatization of the 2008 financial crisis, and it screens as Europe is reeling from the Greek debt crisis. 65-year-old Douglas returns as predatory investment fraudster Gordon Gekko. In the new film, Gekko comes out of jail older and wiser, but with the same reptilian instincts.
Greed is good. Now it seems it's legal.
Wall Street 2 is screening out of competition. Most of the films vying for Cannes' top award this year are independent and arthouse films, and the usually glitzy ambiance of the Riviera Festival is said to be more muted this year, with fewer Hollywood stars walking up the red carpet. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
And I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
On the next Fresh Air, an interview about Lena Horne with her daughter, Gail Lumet Buckley. When her mother first signed with MGM, the studio wanted her to play a maid, but Horne and her father refused.
Teddy Horne the Gambler came out to Hollywood very dapper and demanded an interview very politely with Lulu Mayer and said, "I can afford to hire a maid for my daughter. She doesn't need to play a maid."
Join us
today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. There are many scientists who believe that nanotechnology, and this is a field that involves creating and working with very small things, and many scientists believe that nanotechnology has great potential to change both our economy and the way we live. At the same time, there are people who are worried about the possibility that nanomaterials could be harmful to human health and to the environment. So this morning, in this hour of Focus, our topic is the safety of nanotechnology and whether or not there is reason to be concerned. And our guest is a scientist who has done a lot of writing on this particular subject. We're talking this morning with Dr. Andrew Maynard. He is professor of environmental health sciences and director of the Risk Science Center at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. And he is a leading authority on the responsible development and use of emerging technologies. He is a physicist by his academic training, has PhD in physics from University of Cambridge in the UK. He also is the former chief science advisor for the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. He's joining us this morning by phone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. What I always try to say, at least a few times a week, try to suggest to people that we're happy to have calls, comments and questions, but we also hope that people will be brief. We can keep the program moving that way, get as many callers in as possible. Calling is possible, and welcome. If you'd like to call in, ask a question, make a comment, 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We also have email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Professor Maynard, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure.
I appreciate it. You know, this is a topic that here on the program we have talked about occasionally. We have scientists on this campus that work in nanotech, and they've been on the show, in fact, fairly recently. They were here trying to talk a little bit about nanotechnology, what they see as its potential, some of the areas of research that are going on, and certainly that we did indeed discuss the safety question, which is something that certainly concerns them as well as you and a lot of other scientists. But, you know, I think every time I talk about nanotechnology, I feel I have to start out in the same way, and that is to try to find a way simply to tell people who are not scientists what it is we're talking about here. And actually, I've read some of the things that you have read and written, and they're remarkably clear. I think some of the best writing on this subject I have seen. So now that I've, with that pat on the back, maybe I can ask you to take on that challenge. And just at the beginning here, to help us try to get a better understanding of what really it is we're talking about. What essentially, what are we talking about when we talk about nanotechnology?
Right, right. So you really set me up for a fall there, because so many people have tried and failed to define what this thing is. Probably the best definition of nanotechnology I've heard of, and I'll start with that, comes from the chemist Rick Smalley, who sadly died a few years ago. But he was one of almost the founding fathers of nanotechnology. And he used to describe it very eloquently as the art and the science of building stuff that does stuff at a nanometer scale. So really very, very vague and hand-wavy. And in his eyes, it was all about engineering, but engineering with atoms and molecules rather than large lumps of material. And that really gets to the nub of what this technology is about. So one way of thinking about it is, you think about the world, everything's made up of atoms, everything's made up of molecules. And if only we could actually get down to that really fine scale and manipulate them, put them where we want them to be, we could do amazing things. And if you want proof of that, you just look at nature. Everything around us works at the nanoscale. Plants, animals, any sort of organism works by putting atoms and molecules exactly where they need to be, and it works incredibly well. So the dream is, if only we as humans could do stuff with that level of sophistication, and that's probably at the heart of nanotechnology, just being able to control the things around us as well, or maybe even better than nature does.
So we're talking about here, in my way of thinking about it, we're talking about construction projects that happen on a very small scale that give you the advantage of developing something, and maybe it's you're working with building blocks essentially that you're familiar with, things that already exist in nature, but by being able to manipulate them at that level, what you end up with is something that in fact behaves differently or has different advantages from those things that happen where nature just puts the blocks together.
That's right. So thinking about having different advantages, or in business speak, adding value to products, is probably the best way of looking at it. In some ways, we can just create very sophisticated new materials or products that give us an added advantage by working at that scale. In other cases, you can actually tap into some really unusual physics and chemistry at that scale. So there are some materials where if you begin to engineer them at this very fine scale, they take on a whole new set of properties, and that can be very exciting if you want to develop a new technology or a new product.
And also can be very lucrative, economically advantageous, if you can develop something that either does something that we haven't been able to do before, or perhaps it does something that we can do, but it actually does it a whole lot better.
Absolutely. So, yes, which is why so many people are investing so much money into this area. But it's also potentially good for society as well. If you've got a major challenge that you want to overcome, such as producing energy as cheaply and as efficiently as possible, if you can solve that using nanotechnology, it's good business sense, but it's good social sense as well.
Yeah, and it seems that we have to acknowledge the fact that there already are a lot of applications of nanotechnology. And while indeed we might think it would be great to have light, strong tennis rackets and, you know, pants that if you spill red wine on them, they won't stain, there are other, maybe more serious things. There are medical applications. There are applications in agriculture. There are applications that have to do with dealing with various kinds of environmental problems. So that there are a number of things that are potentially very exciting where you have real benefits. So I, you know, one should really make the point that the potential here really does seem quite exciting.
That's very true. Yes. So a lot of people get exposed to the consumer products, as you say, the lighter, stronger tennis rackets, and so on and so forth. But yeah, the real power here comes in some of the commercial applications.
And maybe, again, it's worth making the point that already there are a stunning number of products available, things that are on the market now that people are using. They may not recognize it, but nanomaterials are already out there in the world. I think some people have counted 1,000-plus things that are on the shelf right now that use nanomaterials.
Yeah, and it's it's a little bit hard to actually get the numbers. I mean, the group that I used to work for at the Woodrow Wilson Center, we put together this online inventory, which you can still access, which lists all the products we were aware of, and there are 1,000-plus products there. Not all of them are still available. But, yeah, without a doubt, you go into a store and look along the shelves, you can guarantee that at least some of those products are going to do what they do because they've been based on nanotechnology in some way.
Yeah. And I suppose it also gets confusing because it seems that there some people like to toss that word around and maybe have decided that it would be cool sounding if something has nano associated with it. Well, it might not have, it might really have nothing to do with nanotechnology. At the same time, some labeling is not required, and it might well be that some producers of consumer products might think, you know, maybe it'd be better if we don't put nano on this product because no telling how people might react to that.
Yeah, well, it was quite funny. If you go back 4 or 5 years, a lot of companies were jumping on the nanotech bandwagon, so you saw this term nano appearing all over the place, and some of those products were really nanotech-based products. But then, all of a sudden, companies got a little bit worried about how people respond to this. So you had a number of products where they surreptitiously removed that nano label. So the products remained the same, but they didn't say anything about using nanotechnology. And that means it's actually very hard to tell what's out there that uses nanotech and what doesn't.
Well, maybe I should very quickly here introduce a guest again, Andrew Maynard. He's a professor of environmental health sciences at University of Michigan and the School of Public Health. He's also director of the Risk Science Center. He's interested in thinking about, writing about, talking about the responsible development and use of emerging technologies. And this that we're talking about here, nanotechnology, is something that he's done a lot of writing about. He is a physicist by his academic training. Also was the former chief science advisor at the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Wilson Center, the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about nanotechnology and how it is we think about the potential risk of this technology. And again, questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, how do we go about thinking about this idea of risk? Or maybe the better question is, well, where does the risk come from? What is it about nanotechnology that we have reason to ask questions about?
Sure. Well, a lot of it, quite frankly, is speculative, but it's reasonable speculation. So you think about it. You have a new technology that comes along where you can do stuff in new ways. There are bound to be new ways in which that technology can cause harm, either harm people or harm the environment. So it's reasonable to assume that there are going to be problems with this new technology. And we've seen that, I think, with every other technology that's come along. You just need to think back to the Industrial Revolution of 100, 200 years ago, and we're still really paying the price for a lot of that. So to start off with, people have been asking, okay, you've got these new materials, these new technologies, they do amazing things because they've been engineered at the nanoscale. What could possibly happen where actually they do something we don't want them to do? Maybe they do harm people. So that was the starting point. But on top of that, there's been a number of bits of research which have indicated that some of these new materials in particular, so materials that have been engineered very exquisitely at this very fine scale, do behave in unusual ways and maybe ways that aren't particularly helpful. We know, for instance, that if you take very, very small particles of material, so these are particles which have only maybe got a few hundred atoms or a few thousand atoms in, and you inhale them, or more specifically an animal inhales them because we don't have much information on humans, we know those particles can be more harmful to those animals than larger particles of the same substance. So that immediately begins to ring some alarm bells and say, well, these new materials maybe aren't behaving quite as predictably as we thought. And if you look at this, we know that some of these materials, they can get to places that you wouldn't normally expect them to get. They can cause harm if they get into the environment or get into people in ways that we wouldn't normally expect. And there's a possibility that they may behave in other ways as well, which are a little bit unpredictable. So there's this sense that if we're going to use some of these new materials and technologies responsibly and wisely, we need to do more science to understand how things can go wrong and how to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that indeed, while initially some of the fears about nanotech centered on self-replicating potential, which I think is maybe not really an issue, but we're concerned about kind of macro size impacts. It seems that here the the issues that really are more or more we're more focusing on have to do with the fact that it's an advantage these things are very small, but that's also where the problems come from. And so we have things that can be inhaled, can be possibly absorbed through the skin, and can penetrate the body at a very deep and intimate level, and that's because they're very small.
I think that's exactly it. So even in that case, the effects that we're worried about, you're likely to see them at a macro level. Mm-hmm. So you get something in your body which is going to be harmful to you. The long-term effects of that are going to be disease or, in the worst possible case, death, which is definitely not a small effect. But you're right. The things that we're really interested in are how these materials interact with organisms at the cellular level, sort of how they get into the body, where they go, and how they begin to behave at that very, very finest of levels, even down to how they might interact with the DNA at the center of the cell. Mm-hmm.
Can you actually give some examples about particular things where there has been some work done and where there's reason to have these kinds of concerns?
Let me talk about just a couple of materials, actually. There are around about 10 to 20 specific materials where there's been a reasonable amount of research, all of them fairly simple materials. But two of them have really been a center of focus. One is a material, titanium dioxide, which is a very, very common material. It's a very white, very insoluble, very inert material found everywhere from paper to icing on cake to almost anything which is white. It's been used for a long, long time. But recently, over the last 10, 20 years or so, manufacturers have been producing this material as very, very small particles, nanoscale particles. So they've been engineering this at a very fine scale and using that to really take advantage of a number of properties of this material. One of those properties in particular is that the material suddenly becomes transparent to visible light when you engineer it at this scale, but it's very good at blocking ultraviolet light, so it makes a great additive for sunscreens, where you want something which is going to look clear on your skin but still protect you from UV. So if you look at this material, which is usually considered to be a very, very safe material, there have been studies that indicate that if it gets into the lungs of a human, it can actually cause a far greater response than you would expect. So this is one of the materials that set off a number of alarm bells. Now, the research doesn't indicate that the stuff is dangerous. It just indicates that it's less safe than we previously thought it was. So that's at one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is a very unusual and innovative material called carbon nanotubes. So this is a form of carbon where the carbon atoms are formed into very long, very thin, hollow fibers. It was discovered about 20 years or so ago. And it has a number of incredible properties in terms of what it can be used for to create new products. But also there's been quite a lot of concern because you're dealing with very, very fine fibers. And the association is with fibers of asbestos, which we know are harmful. So people have been asking for quite some time, does this new fibrous material behave like asbestos? And as a consequence, not surprisingly, there have been quite a number of studies looking at what happens if this stuff gets into the lungs. And there have been indications that this particular material, it might not behave precisely like asbestos, but it's certainly not good to get it into the lungs. You can end up with a response that you wouldn't expect if you just treated it like carbon or like soot or something like that. Mm. So those are two materials where there have been indications that something unusual is happening, something that wouldn't normally be caught if you just took a conventional perspective on how safe something is. And it's made people think that maybe we need to think a little bit differently about how to understand the safety.
Well, in the first case, I guess I would be concerned if we have studies that show a potential toxicity in that's demonstrated in lab test animals for nanotitanium dioxide. I guess that would make me wonder: do I really want to be smearing this stuff on my face? How do we think about that?
And that's where the dilemma comes, actually making sense of these lab studies. Yeah, and I face exactly the same dilemma when I'm putting sunscreen on my kids or on myself. Just because there are some lab studies that show this isn't maybe as safe as I thought it was, does that mean it's harmful and I should avoid it, or is it okay to use? Now, fortunately, in the case of nanotitanium dioxide in sunscreens, the biggest concern there is how is it going to get into the body? And you're putting it on the skin, so the important question is, can those really small particles actually get through the skin and into the body? Unfortunately, research over the last few years has suggested that the skin is actually a really good barrier to those small particles. And once they're on top of the skin, they stay there. They don't go anywhere else. So that actually, it certainly is a consumer myself. That assures me. It makes me think that it doesn't really matter what happens when this stuff gets into the lungs, because I'm not going to be snorting my sunscreen. But when it's on my skin, it's likely to be reasonably safe.
Well, you might also, again, if say if you have a concern about something like carbon nanotubes there, I guess if, say, you have if your tennis racket involves this material, well, then probably as long as it stays in one piece, you're not going to have a problem. But there, I guess, you go to, well, is in some of these cases, is the thing that should concern us most potential industrial exposure. That is in the places where either the material is manufactured or then we take a raw material and we make it into something else. And so there, a big concern should be people who work with this stuff, or maybe, you know, the people who live across the street from the factory where there are people who work with this stuff.
Yep, that's exactly right. So the way that people will typically think about this is, where is the opportunity for exposure to occur? If something is going to cause you harm, it's got to get inside your body. So if you take that tennis racket, the carbon nanotubes are in the racket, they're not in your body, they're not likely to get in there, the chances are it's reasonably safe. But if you go one or two steps forward and you look at the workplace where people are handling the raw material, there's a far greater chance that the stuff's going to get up in the air, they're going to breathe it, it's going to get in the body. You've got to work out what the consequences of that are. So with all of these technologies and products, it's not simply a case of saying, are they harmful or are they not harmful? But it's asking those questions about whether somebody's likely to be exposed to the stuff, where it's likely to go, how much of it is likely to get into their body, and what are the consequences of that going to be.
Yeah. And I suppose, in addition, then there's another kind of question that is the end of life, that is the end of product life
very much
question.
So.
When we talk about, well, when we're done with the thing, what do we do with it, and what potential is there for nanomaterials to then end up getting into the environment in that way?
And that's a critical one. So, in fact, great example of that, another class of products based on nanotechnology, the range of products you can get now which contain nanometer-sized silver particles.
Mm-hmm.
They're put there as an antimicrobial agent, so you can buy socks with silver nanoparticles in which claim to keep your feet relatively odor-free, so I guess you can wear your socks for more days than any sane person would without smelling too much. But yeah, the issue there is what happens when those silver nanoparticles wash out of those products, enter the wastewater, enter the environment, where do they go? What impact do they have? In fact, there's actually a huge amount of research now on exactly that material and exactly that scenario, asking what happens when these get into the sewage works, the water reclamation plants, what happens when they get out into the lakes, the rivers, and organisms start eating these. Are they going to start affecting organisms along the food chain and have an environmental impact in that way? So that really is a critical question.
And that, though, it seems that there, you're not only are there... Do you have a question of when your socks are finally worn out, okay, and you throw them away, what happens? But you'd think that washing them, this is a natural part of having a textile. You know, occasionally you're going to wash them. And in this particular case, it seems like people have found that, yeah, particles of nanosilver wash out. And that's just kind of a fact of life. And if we start putting nanosilver into more textiles for the same kind of reason, or maybe, you know, other kind of nanoparticles, and they in the course of normal wear, these things leach out. Maybe they just fall out. Maybe they're leached out from washing. Eventually, that's going to get into the environment. So that's even above and beyond what happens when you're socks are worn out. That's just a daily kind of issue.
That's it. And especially in the case of silver, silver isn't that harmful to people, but it's very, very harmful indeed to some environmental organisms. So there are critical questions there. And I think one of the issues we face with nanotechnology, in fact, we face it with any new technology, is working out what those important questions are and what the long-term impacts are going to be beyond just what happens in the workplace or what happens to the consumer.
We're at our midpoint. I have a caller. Others are welcome. Again, let me just quickly introduce the guest, Dr. Andrew Maynard. He's a professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan in their School of Public Health. He's also director of the Risk Science Center. He is a physicist by his academic training, and he is very interested in development and use of emerging technologies. And this one in particular, nanotechnology, is something that he's written about quite a lot. He also served for a time as the chief science advisor at the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller here in Champaign County where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi, it's the broader idea about introduction of technologies of various kinds into the society that I wanted to point at, and you just were pointing at that, or referring to that yourself, the idea that, I haven't heard yet the idea of the precautionary principle, which is sort of continental Europe, I think, more than anywhere else where they take that seriously, that something needs to be proved to be safe in longitudinal studies as well as in the near term for them to be allowed on into the, you know, environment. And there was an example of the Germans being so, I guess, infatuated by the whole nanotechnology that they actually did let something go ahead. And I believe there was a fatality involved with a nano substance that you used to coat the inside of your shower so that you didn't have to scrub it as hard to clean it or something. You may know the details of that. But there actually was a fatality in Germany from nano chemicals. But I also just wanted to point out, and maybe the hosts' minions are working on this, but there's just been a release of a new study about how much cancer it could actually be attributed to environmental toxins. It obviously gets ahead of, it's not to do with nanotechnology, but there's a big controversy swirling about that right now. There's something like something approaching 40% of cancers are unexplained as to their etiology, I guess is the right word. And the current guess on what environmental pollution has is about 6%, but there's some people saying that that's really, really more study needs to be done to see how much is actually involved in that. So a couple of digressions there, but thank you.
All right.
Yeah, so a number of things to address. And isn't it funny that you go to Europe where you have the precautionary principle that's one of the biggest instances, allegedly, of a nanotech product causing harm was in Europe, in Germany. So just dealing with that to start with, this was a project called Magic Nano, and it hit the market several years ago. It was a bathroom sealant product, so it was a product that was designed to spray on surfaces in the bathroom and kill bacteria, not kill bacteria in this case, but keep them clean. It was a product that was supposedly based on nanotechnology, had nanoparticles in, and worked fine as a pump spray action product. But in this case, they put it into an aerosol can, and within a matter of days of it being released onto the market, a number of people complained of respiratory symptoms. Some of them got very sick. By my recollection, nobody actually died, but there were several cases of people being hospitalized. And the fear at the time was that the problem was the nanocomponent of this spray. As it turned out, rather ironically, the spray was neither magic nor nano. They actually discovered that by some fault of the manufacturing process, there was no nanotechnology component to it. And almost definitely what caused the problem was a new propellant that they put into the product before it went out onto the market. But yes, that was a case that raised a lot of concerns because it seemed at the time that nanotechnology entering the market was actually causing a problem. But it also raised awareness that if you're putting any sort of new technology out there, you've got to make sure you're asking the right questions before people start using it and people start getting exposed to the stuff. But that also raises the question of the precautionary principle, and I always find this fun being a European. I come from Britain, where we're used to this idea of being cautious about what goes on to the market and working out how it can cause harm before we actually get it there. But you come to the States, and the precautionary principle is just a phrase that you never use in business circles. Having said that, most decisions that are made, whether you're in America or Europe or anywhere else, in terms of whether you put a product on the market, are precautionary decisions that are made. People think very, very carefully about putting something out and whether it's going to cause harm to people or harm to the environment. And generally, people recognize that it's actually bad business sense to put something out there that is going to cause harm.
Well, who, though, ultimately, say, for example, we talked about the fact that there are a lot of consumer products out there that use nanomaterials and that there have been maybe 10 to 20 nanomaterials that where there has been particular, there has been some research where there are some concerns raised, and at least we're thinking about it. And we named three, carbon nanotubes, nanotitanium dioxide, and nanosilver, and then there are probably some others that we could come up with. So who are the people that are doing this relatively small but amount of research that's going on? I mean, where is it happening?
It's happening in a number of places. And so if you look at America in particular, there are a number of centers of expertise across the country where you have people who are expert in exposure, in toxicity, toxicology, in a number of other areas that are coming together to work out what needs to be done here and carrying out the necessary research. Having said that, though, there are huge gaps in the research that's going on as well as our knowledge at the moment. And that brings us to the question of, well, who's supposed to be pushing this research agenda? Who's supposed to be funding it? And the answer there is that the government is funding a lot of this research, which, and in effect, of course, it's the government who decide how much money or how little money goes into this type of research. But it's also the government that, in principle, are working out what are the important research questions to be asked here. And whether they're actually being asked is it's questionable at the moment. I would actually say I've worked in this area a number of years, and it seems like there are a number of questions screaming out to be answered that really aren't being answered that fast.
Such as?
Well, just a couple. Go back to the carbon nanotubes and this question of whether they behave like asbestos or not. We've seen an increase in research in that area in recent years, but the first time this question of whether carbon nanotubes behave like asbestos was asked was back at the beginning of the 1990s, and it took us nearly 15 years before anybody took that seriously. And so it would be actually great to see a rapid ramping up of research in that area, even if it's only to put the question to bed. The other area is asking what happens when this stuff gets into your gut, if you're eating something which contains a nanoscale material, or if it inadvertently gets into your mouth and gets into your stomach. There really has been very, very little research there indeed.
Hmm. Well, that gets you thinking, well, you know, in a relatively short period of time, the number of consumer products that involve some kind of nanomaterials has grown. It's blown up. It's exploded. Whatever kind of cliche you want to use, that over a relatively short period of time, the number of products have grown very dramatically. This is running ahead by leaps and bounds. But it doesn't. Our effort to try to understand these things and potential hazards really is lagging behind, even on these handful of things where we have reason for concern and people have raised the issue for years and years.
It is. Unfortunately, my sense is that many of the products on the market at the moment are going to turn out to be reasonably safe, so we may have dodged a bullet there. But having said that, the research still is lagging behind the products entering the market, sadly. And there's always that possibility that something will turn up that we really hadn't anticipated. The thing that concerns me even more, though, is with the next generations of nanotech-based products that are going to be coming along. If we can't deal with the really simple stuff, how on earth are we going to get ahead of the game with the research, with the more complex stuff that we're likely to see in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, is it the case that, as far as research goes, government-funded research, that there's only so much money and there are so many different things that we think we might want to be doing, and it has something to do with the process of how it is we hand out what money there is? Is it that we're not allocating enough money toward research? Why is it that we've recognized here there are some very important questions with very potential, seriously potential impacts? Why aren't we doing it?
I think it's a number of factors. So money is obviously a factor. That there's never enough money to go around with scientific research, and typically if somebody wants to research possible risks, it's even harder to get money out of the pot. It's always easier if you're going to have a product at the end of the day that you can sell. But it's more than just money, I think. I think it's having a critical view on what the important research questions are. And this has been sorely lacking over the last few years, where there hasn't been a sense of what the important areas of research are. So you've ended up with money being invested in areas that maybe aren't that important and money not being invested in areas that it should have been. Now, there have been a number of efforts to try and correct that, and I'm involved in one at the moment coming out of the National Academies of Science, where we're trying to put together a research strategy which will hopefully help governments and other funding bodies to guide where they put the money. But it's really difficult to actually make sure that limited resources are channeled in the most appropriate way.
When it comes to nano risk assessment, do we even have any kind of national policy?
Not specifically with nano risk assessments. There are fairly well established approaches to assessing new risks and addressing them. But we seem to be lacking a number of the rules which are needed for dealing with nanomaterials, especially those which seem to behave in unusual ways or don't quite conform to how we expect things to behave in these tests. So that's something we're struggling with. But actually, there's something related to that which we're struggling with even more, which is applicable to a range of new technologies. And that is, it seems likely that as the sort of cycle of technology development gets ever faster, we will never have all the neat bits of information we ideally want or need to carry out a quantitative risk assessment to say definitely this is what we do, which means we need new ways of making decisions in the absence of hard data.
Boy, that seems to point to a really serious issue, because I think all along there has always been, I think we've always had a problem with assessing new technologies. And if we have something that looks particularly beneficial, and if there's possibility that somebody can make money at it, and there doesn't seem to be any obvious problem, we tend to be fairly enthusiastic about those things. And the asking of the question and then trying to get an answer of the question sometimes comes a long time later.
It does. And I feel we've got away with that for a long time, but we can't get away with it anymore. So that's been the history of the last 100 years, and we've had a lot of problems, but we've had a lot of successes. The trouble is technology is going so fast now that I think our missteps are going to catch up with us incredibly rapidly. But the only solution to that really is to find new ways of making the best possible decision before we've got all the information we need.
That's kind of scary. What you're saying there is kind of scary to me, especially when you talk about how, you know, our past missteps catching up.
Right. But the good news is that there are some ways which we can do this, or some ways in which we can do it more effectively than we've done it in the past. So even just as simply as if you've got a new technology coming along, asking the experts, the people that know, what they think the big issues are going to be and how they think we might avoid those. Mm-hmm. That's not hard science, but at least it points you in the right direction to making good decisions.
And how, though, do you balance that against interests? And we know there will be interests, economic interests here, people in whose interest it will be to develop products and who will want to go ahead and do that.
Sure. And that's always the tension. Especially, again, you look at the U.S., which is really built on innovation. There's this fear that even just talking about risks is going to stifle innovation. It's going to stop new products coming out. It's going to stop the money that comes from those products. But the reality is, and I think a lot of corporations are realizing these days, that if you're going to have sustainable products, and that's products which are going to be successful over 10, 20, 50 years or so, you've got to think about the potential impacts up front. You can't just drive full steam ahead with innovation. You've got to carry out what people are now calling responsible innovation, which is innovation where you actually think of the consequences ahead of time. And that's slowly becoming a business model, certainly in some of the larger organizations.
We have now about 10 minutes left in this hour of focus. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Maynard. He's professor of environmental health sciences at University of Michigan in their School of Public Health. He's also director of the Risk Science Center. He is a physicist and is also interested in his work in how we think about developing and using emerging technologies. And this that we're talking about here this morning, nanotechnology, is something that he's done a lot of writing about. He is former chief science advisor at the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. And if you have questions, they are certainly welcome. Again, as I said, we have about 10 minutes left. So if you'd like to get into the conversation, you certainly may. You can phone us at 333-9455 if you're in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So anywhere, you can use that number. And email is also possible, will-talk@illinois.edu. We've talked here, and you certainly have talked about this, but I guess I'm interested in this larger question about how it is we think about new technologies and how it is that we balance our enthusiasm for these things' potential with some caution about potential negative effects.
Yeah.
How do we do that? How do we make that a part of the way that we think?
I think there are a number of ways forward. So you've got the whole business of just trying to predict what the actual harm might be if you take a certain course of action and modifying that course of action. And you can do that based on the current state of knowledge, just by almost intuition, looking at what happens in other areas and cross-applying lessons. You can also take a more proactive approach if you do the science right, and you can actually work out how to engineer safety into some of these new technologies. So maybe you're a business and you've got three or four potential new materials you're going to develop. You can actually look at the science and work out which one of those materials is going to give you the highest degree of added value in your products and at the same time the least amount of safety issues. So that's one way of moving forward. But there's another aspect of that as well, which is becoming increasingly important, and that's what people within the broader social sphere think about these new technologies and the way they're likely to respond to it. So there's a societal dimension there. And of course, the reality is that if something hits the street and people either perceive there to be a risk, or they perceive that technology to have been introduced against that will, or they just don't like it, you're going to have a problem with that particular product or that technology. And that's leading a lot of people to think about how you actually bring a much wider range of people to the table at the point of innovation. So you end up with innovations and technologies which are going to be not only safe but also acceptable to the people that are using them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an interesting question. I'm sure that you can do that in all sorts of ways. But if you're a manufacturer and you have a potential product and you're getting people together and you're trying to show it to them and say, well, what do you think about this? Isn't this great? Are you truly going to how are you going to present it? And are you going to present it to them in a way that's like, hey, this is the greatest thing you've ever seen in your life, and it's wonderful, you're going to love it, and isn't it great?
That's right, which means you need some degree of independent assessment. Yeah. And a savvy company will realize this. If they're going to be in the market for a long period of time, they need somebody that's outside the loop to take this forward. And there have been efforts to do that. In fact, there are efforts just developing at the moment. There's an idea called participatory technology assessment. This is an initiative that was launched just recently in the States, where they look at developing an independent group of organizations that can actually help this process along.
Do you just – this maybe it's a little bit of a different subject, but related. Do you think that it would be a good thing, whether it's – it would be difficult to do, but do you think that it would be a good thing to have some sort of labeling on products that have nanoparticles in them as a way of informing consumers that, well, this stuff is there in the product?
Sure. It's a really tricky issue, and I would answer that by saying, no, I don't think it would be helpful to have a label that says nano inside or something like that. But I do think it's important that consumers and others have access to good information about what's in the products. So if you have a product that contains nanometer-sized particles, it's useful to make that information available, not necessarily because it flags up a safety issue, but simply because if somebody wants to make an informed choice, they have access to that information. Now, there's a problem there and there's a solution. The problem is, if you go along this road, you end up with lists of components in products which are so long that you can't actually physically put them onto the product as soon as you start putting nano in front of everything. The solution that some people have talked about is actually to have online resources. So you pick up a product off the shelf. It has either a code or a barcode or something like that that allows you to plug information into the net, and that actually pulls up fairly detailed information about what went into that product. And that then gives you the ability to assess whether that's something that you're concerned about, interested about, whatever, and make an informed decision.
I have a question here that came in from someone who's listening and came in by email, who were interested in perhaps hearing a little bit more about safety testing that's done in Europe. They're interested in whether, for example, European countries are more likely to do it, whether there's more government money available to do that than there is in the United States. The observation of the listener is that it seems to him that here in this country, we're much more focused on developing products as fast as we can so that we can roll them out in the marketplace so someone can profit from them.
Sure, and it depends on the product. So if you're developing a drug, there is an awful lot of testing. If you're developing a dietary supplement, there's very, very little testing required. But in many cases, the level of testing that's required in Europe is greater than it is in the U.S. And just one particular example, if you look at chemicals, there is new chemicals regulation in Europe where the mantra following those regulations is no data, no market. In other words, it's up to the companies to show that their materials are safe before they start selling them. Things aren't quite that robust in the States yet.
Yeah. Well, that I think it goes back to the comment of the earlier caller that the orientation there might be slightly different, that perhaps it's a responsibility of someone who wants to manufacture and sell something to demonstrate that it's safe, rather than the approach that we seem to take often here is that sometime later, somebody else, it's up to them to demonstrate that it's not before the government will really get involved in that whole question.
There is certainly some of that, and it's always a little bit dangerous dealing with generalities. Mm-hmm. But if you look at Europe, there is much more of a feel that social good or the social benefits of whatever goes on are important, as opposed to the U.S., where there has typically, certainly over the last 8 years, been a push on innovation that basically says, let's get the markets out and the societal good will naturally come from having good products on the market.
We have, we have a couple minutes here. If someone wants to call and get involved here, don't wait till the very last minute. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you may also send your emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we're coming down here to the end of our time. We have a couple of minutes left. And I guess if it seems that if you ask this question, well, what are the potential hazards, or are there potential hazards associated with nanotechnology or with nanomaterials? It seems that really at this moment the answer to the question is, well, we're not actually sure. There are some things that we have reason to be concerned about and we have done some work on. But I think it's one question one might ask is, with this whole question of potential harm, are we actually capable of answering that question?
We're getting close to it. Well, actually, no. Let me revise that. In some ways, we're getting close to it. In other ways, we don't even know the questions we're supposed to be asking yet. Mm-hmm. So we're in a situation here where I don't think we've missed the boat. We're making reasonable progress. But unless we work out how to ask the right questions about safety with these new technologies, we're going to run into severe problems in a few years' time when some really innovative technologies come along.
Well, it's surely that it is the case that we have done assessment of risk before in connection with other things. Is it, for example, there's this concern about carbon nanotubes and the idea that they might behave similarly to asbestos and cause similar problems when inhaled into the lungs. Well, you might think, well, We did that for asbestos. We kind of know how to do that. Is it really so hard to apply the same method to carbon nanotubes?
And it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be, which is why I'm a little surprised there hasn't been more done up to now. There are some really complex issues here, but there are also some simple things which we haven't done to the extent that maybe we should have done. So maybe this is a lesson that we need to learn as we move forward.
Mm. How much of it actually does have to do with deciding, and I'm not sure at what level that happens or who does it, but deciding that it's important?
That's absolutely critical, and that's perhaps the biggest barrier to what you might call proactive risk assessment, doing the risk assessment before something bad has happened, actually convincing people that it's worthwhile doing, that it is important. Mm-hmm. And I think we're getting there slowly, but there's still a long way to go.
Here, I just got in another email here, and I think this is a good question because, again, it raises this issue that, well, for most of us, the way that we're going to deal with this is as consumers, and so the question is, well, what do we do? For example, the caller here earlier heard this concern that you had about, well, we really don't know what nanosubstances will do in the gut, that is, if we eat them. So she's and here she's thinking, well, how do we keep young kids who put everything in their mouths safe? And she says, are we really supposed to go home with every sunscreen on the market and check the ingredients on the internet? She says, this scares me to death. I have no idea how to keep my very young grandchild away from this stuff. He has a lot of years for potential harm to develop in his body. And that's the level I think most of the people are going to be at.
Right. And I don't think anybody has got any good answers. The one thing I would say is that there aren't the indicators of there being a serious problem here. So you take sunscreens. I certainly wouldn't worry too much about them, even the nanomaterial-containing sunscreens. I think this is more of a research question at the moment, and it's more a question of getting the way we do things right so that when something that is seriously of concern comes along, we can actually deal with it. Now, having said that, I think there may potentially be issues that arise with stuff that's on the market at the moment, but there aren't those huge, great red warning flags that say danger, danger.
Mm. Well, here now we've got to wrap up, and obviously for somebody like you, for scientists or people who are on that end of this, they approach this on one way. But as I and the person who wrote in that email, well, we approach it on another way. How would you suggest that people think about this?
I think there needs to be a certain amount of what I would call skeptical trust in government and in industries. So hope that they're doing the right thing, but don't be scared to question that. Apart from that, it's a case of being aware, asking critical questions, and don't just focus on the nano. Focus on the alternatives as well. So you look at the sunscreens. Okay, so the stuff we don't know about nano ingredients, the stuff we do know about the conventional ingredients, and it's not all good.
Well, at that, well, on a cheerful note, we will finish up. Our guest, Andrew Maynard, he is professor of environmental health sciences at the University of Michigan in their School of Public Health, former chief science advisor at the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Maynard, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the SUSE Archives and Center for American Music, where visitors of all ages can uncover and discover the wonderment of America's musical past through guided tours Monday through Friday at the University of Illinois. More information is at SUSEArchives.org. Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign. Along with their dinner menu, tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m. Lunch is also served on Friday from 10:30 to 2:30 and brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Information on menus and wine and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
Well, that's it for us here on Focus Food this week, but we want you to stay tuned. There's more coming up. News, weather, some features, a lot of other things, all as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host for that show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Good morning. It's 2 minutes before noon. This is WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, July wheat is trading at 491.5. That's down 5.25. In Chicago, May wheat 463, down 8. July 472.25, down 6.75. May corn 356, down 10.5. July 364.5, down 8.5. September 371.5, down 8.25. December 381, down 8. May soybeans 950.5, down 10. July 954, down 10.5. August 948, down 10.5. September 930, down 12. May meal 282.20, down 2.20. May oil 37.22, down 58. June live cattle 94 even, down 157 and a half. August 92.85, down 180. May feeder cattle 110.10, down 162 and a half. August 113.35, down 172 and a half. May lean hogs 88.30. That is down 12 and a half. June crude 71.41, down 2.99. On Wall Street, the Dow is off 178 points at 10,605. The Nasdaq is off 56 at 23.38, and the S&P 500 is down 23 at 11.35. The forecast for Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, partly to mostly sunny, the high near 70, winds from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour. At noon,